Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider.
Here we are with a YouTube podcast. We're getting back to the podcast mode. I apologize for us taking a while. We have a radio show now called Promotion Man Radio Show that's available to any classic rock station anywhere. It's an hour, comes with 48 minutes of show and then 12 minutes of commercials. So anybody that's listening out there, you can email us at thepromotionman@gmail.com.
Over the holidays, Fred and I got a Promotion Man vaccine, so we decided we could we were free to give you some more podcasts again, Matt.
Yeah. So one of the stories I've always wanted to tell you guys was about U2, because we had Warner Brothers distributed Island, and U2 was released in 1980.
Right.
And it was interesting because, you know, the band is an Irish rock band from Dublin. They were formed in 1976, and their first album came out in 1980, and it was the album Boy.
Did they ever tell you why they call that album that? I've always been curious, you know, it's like, because I never asked bands, like, well, why did you name the album this? But that one seems interesting for a debut title.
You know, and I never did, but here's my firsthand experience with the band. I had already been transferred from Detroit to Houston, so Houston was my new territory. And Austin happened to be where the University of Texas was, which was about 40,000 students.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the capital of Texas, and a fast-growing, merging city of its own.
Right.
And when you have a university and you have music like reggae and punk and ska and different new things, just like you, Lloyd, when you were a DJ in college,
right?
That was, you would be willing to give a chance because you're not worried about the ratings like a publicly or a privately owned radio station,
right?
Correct.
Right. Yeah, and of course, college radio gave us the opportunity to break some new artists. College students definitely listen to radio with more of an open mind. And bands like U2, you know, around 1980, when I first played them in my college radio station, immediately the audience took notice and they became pretty popular very fast.
Well, so here's what happened, though. If you go back to that era, that's when punk was very much a movement and new wave. And you have to understand that, and I remember so clearly, and I still have these buttons where it was a small white button. Everyone was wearing buttons on their, you know, Levi jacket or whatever, their leather jacket. And there was, it just said the letter U and then the number two. And I think radio thought or felt like they would just group them into the punk, you know, world, if you will. And they were not a punk band. So the very first week that the song was released by Island Records, distributed by Warner Brothers, to get an ad on the radio was you had every local rep would go to their radio stations and beg, borrow, steal, cajole, convince them to give this a chance. And that first week, there were three radio stations that decided to play the brand new U2, I Will Follow.
Right.
And one was, the biggest one was WBCN in Boston.
Yeah.
Which was always known to be a leader in this type of stuff anyway. People right. would really follow them. But then it was KLBJ FM here in the studios that were recording this podcast.
I Will Follow them.
And then KNCN C101 in Corpus Christi.
Wow. So that's the three that really kind of led the way on U2.
And because I'm somewhat competitive and I wanted to do well with my company, I had two out of the three. So I was pretty stoked about
that. So they allowed you, I'm sure, a little access to the band that you're getting this first exposure for them in America, right?
Excellent question, Lloyd, because then what happens is once the airplay begins, you want to get the band out there. And you want to put them in anywhere that you can book them.
Right.
So that you can start to expose them to the general public and get that buzz going. So there was a local promotion, I mean, a production guy, a guy, a concert booker named Jim Ramsey.
Oh, yeah. I know Jim.
God rest his soul. He passed away about 5 years ago.
He booked a lot of shows in Texas, man. I got to tell you, I've seen every band imaginable, and he was usually the one that put them there.
And here's the thing that Jim was telling me about, because we talked about this. And he said that that band was so loyal. It's kind of like the way they were made up, who they were as human beings.
Right.
That, first of all, we should discuss that they were very religious.
Yeah.
Their faith was huge. And the Edge wasn't sure if he could commit to the band because he didn't want to be taken away from his faith.
Right.
And it was very challenging. And they had a lot of deep soul searching and conversations about that. And if you listen to a lot of their lyrics, you'll see what I'm talking about. But that also gives you an idea of who these guys are that make up the band U2. And
let me ask you this. Now, I think, you know, since you said, you know, they had pretty deep beliefs and faith and everything, I got to think that even as a new baby band, if you will, they weren't out there doing sex, drugs, and rock and roll pretty much. They were kind of probably well-mannered Irish boys, I guess. Huh?
That's exactly right. So here's what Jim Ramsey had said. He goes, Fred, they were such loyal human beings that when we booked them together, me and you, we had them in a club here in Austin called Clubfoot. It was 100 kids.
Right.
It was located down in the core of Austin where there were railroad tracks still in the street today.
Wow.
Where the building was where they would unload freight. And so somebody took that specific building and turned it into this club called Clubfoot. And they had a Lincoln Continental chassis of a car as the back bar. And something happened that day that I had told on a lot of rock and roll tour buses to a lot of bands. And that is that the only song that was being played that was exposed was I Will Follow.
Right.
I was lucky enough to get Edge and Bono in my car and take them to KLBJ Studios, which was located down in the city at the time.
What were you driving at the time?
I can't remember because I know you asked me that a lot. It wasn't my Nova. You know, I even owned a Gremlin.
Yeah.
I hate to admit that. But anyway.
I hope that's what you have when you took you two around in a Gremlin.
No, that's
a great story to
tell. No, I have to think about it. But it was a normal four-door car. But bottom line is they were kind of amazed that I was taking them to a radio station where the call letters were KLBJ.
Right.
And they were so inquisitive that Lyndon Baines Johnson actually had ownership of a rock and roll radio station.
That probably was unique from a band, you know, looking to America from Dublin going like, wait a minute, a former president owns a rock station? That's pretty crazy.
And this was probably one of a handful of their very first radio interviews, period.
Yeah. So how was that interview?
Well, the guy who did it, again, someone who had passed away, the late, great Tom Quarles.
TQ,
that's what he went by. He was a fascinating guy because he was eccentric just like the bands were.
Right.
And so he was smart enough to really do his homework, ask really wonderful questions, which always made a radio interview so well done, you know, because they're thoughtful. The questions are thoughtful. And so he understood that the Edge had a different way of attacking his guitar. You know, it wasn't a lead like a ripping lead. It was a so much different finesse. It was
right.
It was always focused on the string more than the chords. So it went off beautifully. He did some great questions. They were wonderful. He played several tracks on the album. And then that night, we had our first show.
Yeah.
And I remember clearly trying to hand out tickets, and I could see the capital of Austin in the foreground, you know, glowing in the white. And it was a fall evening. And there were 100 kids. But here's what they did that I thought was amazing. They came out and went right into I Will Follow and got the crowd absolutely crazy. Then they played their whole show. The kids loved it. I mean, it was an amazing energy, great show. We go backstage.
How long was the set?
You know, I'm going to say an hour, 45 minutes to an hour.
Right, right.
And I don't even remember if there was an opening band. I don't remember any of that. But well, here's what I do remember. They take a break. back then you wanted an encore. Mm. That kind of solidified that you delivered to the audience and they want more.
Right.
So they were kind of waiting for the encore, which was definitely happening. The crowd was going crazy. They kind of changed shirts, toweled down, drink water. And then Bono said, "You guys ready?" And they said, "Yep." And they went right back on stage. And you know what they did? They played "I Will Follow" again.
Kind of like bookends.
But it was such a brilliant marketing move.
I mean,
you know?
I think Bono knew exactly what he was doing. He's a smart guy. He's really down to earth. And I mean, he's really become...
He's deep.
He's just one of the most phenomenal speakers and just, you know, people he's introduced into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, his speeches are just beautiful, you know?
So going back to Jim Ramsey, as the band grew in popularity, guess who they chose to book the shows here in this part of the country?
Jim.
And so now he got a chance to participate in their success.
Wow.
Because obviously he makes money with every ticket sold.
Yeah.
And back then, in the very beginning of this era that we're talking about, him and Bono went out to dinner. And Bono had said to Jim, in no uncertain terms, he said, "You know, we're being pushed in this punk thing."
Right.
He said, "But we're not a punk band. We're a rock and roll band, and we have a lot to say." Think about that right there.
So who do you think was the one that kind of labeled them? Was it the record company or was it radio DJ?
No, it was radio DJ. So here's what happens. The next show I have is in Houston.
Yeah.
And there was this rock and roll club called Cardi's. And I think there was a couple of them. I think there was one in Dallas, one in Houston. Well, this time, Peter McGinnis, who's been known to be one of the most powerful and relentless band managers ever. And I have a story about him in this podcast we'll get to. But he was an older British guy. So we're all like 23, 24, 25 years old, and he's probably in his 50s. So he comes to the show in Houston at Cardi's. I really don't think I had airplay. I think I was trying to get the rock station there, KLOL, to play it. But I don't remember if I got him to play it before the show, but I know I got him to play it after the show. They eventually played it. But they were now getting frustrated that the song wasn't growing fast enough around the country. So I remember clearly backstage that Bono and Peter McGinnis kind of had me in a lot of ways kind of cornered. I was getting a little defensive. And Peter in particular was angry, not at me, but I was getting the wrath of his anger. Because he really wanted to know, and he asked me, "Why isn't American radio playing this song?"
Right.
And I was so proud that I had more radio airplay than anybody else in the country.
Yeah.
So I thought I was in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
But the truth is, he actually even grabbed my shirt collar and kind of held on to it.
Wow.
And he was that angry. And I said, "Sir, the only thing I can tell you is that right now they're being lumped into the punk category when they're just, as you know, a great rock and roll band."
Right.
And that's when Bono, I'm 6'4", and he kind of got on his tippy toes, you know, and he kind of said, "We are a rock and roll band. We need to be treated like a rock and roll band." And, you know, and he was just very decisive about all of that. And at that moment, I got to be honest, I've never had that happen to me.
Right.
And I didn't quite know what to do with all of that. But
well, I think they kind of swept the punk thing under the rug when they came out in 83 with War. I mean, you're talking Sunday Bloody Sunday, Pride in the Name of Love. This is where I think the band really established itself as a social conscious kind of band, had a message, and the music was right on target for the time.
I couldn't agree more, but here's the other thing. And here's something I don't know the answer to. And if anybody knows, thepromotionman@gmail.com, because I'd love to know.
Yeah.
We were distributing islands. So we had Bob Marley. We had U2. We had Steve Winwood. We had all these different island bands as Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
But we had the second album, which had Gloria.
Right.
And that was the first single that that MTV grabbed onto.
Right.
So all of a sudden, it was the first song that the music video MTV played that started to generate some excitement for them. They went out on tour and opened for actually Jay Giles' band, which isn't really a great fit. But Jay Giles at that time had Centerfold. They were on the top of the game in their world. And that was the last record I worked with them. And then all of a sudden, they were on a sister label of WEA Atlantic.
Right.
And that part I never knew. Now, we did a podcast with Ken Kushnick, who explained that we had this round robin where, you know, different labels would grab newer music. But I think Peter McGinnis in particular was so angry at the lack of airplay that I think they literally made some changes, and it was probably an anomaly that Atlantic started working Island Records when that was a deal with Warner Brothers. But here again, I don't have the answer to that.
Again, smart move on their part because, like you said, you know, they've established themselves on rock radio with the songs we talked about, Sunday Bloody Sunday, Pride in the Name of Love. And then I remember, man, you know, of course, Live Aid, they performed there. And that's when we really saw what Bono was made up of as a front man. And, of course, moving on past that, it's the one that just changed everything in 1987 in the Joshua Tree. I mean, tell me how that album affected you.
You know what? That was such a great album. And earlier, before this podcast, we were talking about the Dr. Dre...
Jimmy Iovine.
Chewy, what was the name of that?
The Defiant Ones.
The Defiant Ones.
Right.
Everyone needs to go watch that series. I think there was 6 or 7 episodes.
It's awesome.
It's incredible. It's so well done. It's so informative. There's so many things you learn about Dr. Dre, about you know, the music at that time. But it was Jimmy Iovine who they were now working with, and he was producing their records, and he said they wore him out. Like, he worked with John Lennon. He worked with, you know, Tom Petty. He worked with so many great bands.
Right.
But he said he got to the point with U2 that they were just literally taking every ounce of who he was inside of him.
Yeah.
But that's how deep these guys were, you know?
Did you actually see that Joshua Tree tour?
I did.
Oh, man. It was...
It was incredible.
It was life-changing.
And then Red Rocks is this wonderful natural venue just outside of Denver.
Yeah.
It's naturally formed. It has natural acoustics. It's an incredible venue. And that live album, Unforgettable Fire, was incredible setting. And, you know, that was really good from a visual standpoint.
And if you want to see what Fred's talking about, they actually shot Sunday Bloody Sunday, one of their live videos there at Red Rocks, too. I mean, he's got the fire going. He's waving the flag. The crowd's going crazy. So what an amazing performance there at Red Rocks.
Yeah. And so here the thing is, my whole world has been music. So now my children have grown up to music. So I remember being on a ski trip. And my daughter, Lauren, and my son, Chase, and U2 had started to lose favor with the Zoo TV. And all of a sudden, they just weren't bringing out the kind of music that they had become known for.
Right. But let me, before you get to that, let's kind of talk about what led up to that. Because I remember I was in Myrtle Beach at the time around 1988 after the Joshua Tree had come out. And they came to the radio station for us to be the presenter for that live movie, Rattle and Hum.
Oh, but Rattle and Hum was great.
Well, you know, it was great, but a lot of people, a lot of critics thought that it kind of showed the band had kind of hit a point where they got so big. You know when a band gets so big and then it's like, how do you ever top that? So they came out with this movie and it seemed like that was going to be something great, but... You know what? The response we saw, at least locally where I was at, fans didn't dig it as much as they did. So it seems like in the 90s came, as you're about to talk about, they kind of had to reinvent themselves.
There's no question. And I think it was the Pop Mart tour that really put a challenge into them because just like you'd said, they'd reached such a pinnacle and they couldn't seem to keep it up. So my kid, we're on a ski trip, and if you drive Colorado mountains, you're just doing nothing but switchbacks.
Right.
And I had just gotten my hands on the album about Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, the Vertigo Tour.
Right.
And I was telling my kids, I go, man, if this album doesn't bring them back, I just don't know what's going to happen to this band.
Yeah.
And today, I really love the Dismantle Atomic Bomb album. There's so many songs on there that I find incredibly good.
Yeah.
Songs I relate to and things I continue to listen to. But this band has performed at Super Bowl halftime shows.
Yeah.
They have going on to sell 150 to 200 million albums.
I remember back on the Zoo TV tour, I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and they played at Dodger Stadium. And just the setup of the stage and the lights, and there was some part in the middle of the show that I think Bono actually called the White House or something, because I don't remember exactly what the story was behind that part. I'll have to go back and look it up. But another great tour, man. I mean, that's when I saw the 90s were definitely a different decade, and so was U2 as a different band, man. They embraced it, I think, in the right way.
And then I have another thing I want to lay out there to the listeners, because this is something I don't have the answer to either. But the band had gone on to be one of the most powerful recording bands out there.
Right.
And from a dollar standpoint, there was a time that Island Records was going through financial hardship.
Right.
And I believe that U2's contract was coming up, which made them a free agent. And it was Peter McGinnis who cut some sort of deal that said, we'll stay.
Yeah.
But we want 10% equity of Island Records.
Wow.
And again, I don't have all the facts, and I wish I did, because this always fascinated me. But that's how I think Interscope eventually bought Island Records,
right,
and spent a significant amount of money, which meant that if U2 had that position, then when it was purchased, they got a huge lump sum of money as well.
Let me ask you a question. Have you ever been to Dublin?
No.
I have, and I've seen Bono's house. I've seen the Edge's house. And yes, they got a really good deal.
Are they houses or castles?
They're kind of, you know, castles. But, I mean, when we went over there, they were actually remodeling Bono's house. So he had a lot of plastic and stuff hanging over the side. So I really couldn't see the house that great, but it was huge.
Wow. Well, you know, I wanted more people on this podcast because I wanted more U2 stories.
Yeah.
And there was a young lady I was trying to get to participate, and she just wasn't feeling it for whatever reason. But she became very close friends with them. And
right.
I know that she stayed at Clayton's house, and they're close friends. And maybe at some point she'll feel better and want to do an interview with us, because these are the stories that really are what make the Promotion Man podcast such a, you know, great podcast.
Right. I totally agree with you, man. And I'm really glad we had a chance to do you too. And I have a feeling we'll be revisiting this in another podcast, and definitely on the Promotion Man radio show too.
Yes. And again, for you faithful listeners of the podcast, thank you. I know we haven't been as consistent as we were, and that's because this radio show is so much fun, because we can add music where copyright infringement doesn't allow us to play music in podcasts.
Right.
So if you ever want to hear the podcasts in their entirety, you can listen to them live at www.klbjfm.com.
Yeah.
Click on Listen Live, and they play every Sunday night at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Right, right. So you can get the stories that we give you here on the podcast, along with the great music that you wanted to do at the beginning, and it all yeah. came to fruition, man.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun. The radio show and the podcast together, they definitely complement each other.
They really do, and they're a lot of fun. And again, grab your iPhone right now. Go click the podcast icon. It's the purple one.
Right.
And then go ahead and subscribe to Promotion Man Podcast. Go ahead and give us a 5-star review. Thank you very much in advance.
Yes, we appreciate it. And so any way you want to consume it, I mean, we're on Alexa, we're on Apple, we're on Google, pretty much anywhere that does podcasts, just say play Promotion Man or search Promotion Man, and you'll find 50 plus great stories about some amazing bands that have created what we call rock and roll.
Yeah, I think this will be episode, I think, 51.
Yeah,
okay. I think. And we do have a Facebook page that is about to crest 10,000 followers.
Right.
So it's Promotion Man Podcast Facebook page.
Right.
And what else do we have to tell them?
The
10th caller will give you $1 million.
It's a new year. 2020 is behind us, and we're hoping for the best for 2021, man. It's been a crazy ride for the last few months, man. So hoping we can get this back on a more consistent basis, and definitely tune in on the radio show Sunday night, 6 o'clock Central, klbjfm.com. Just click on the Listen Live and you'll hear the show.
And the next podcast we have on deck is a gentleman named Paul Fishkin.
Yeah.
Who was with with Foghat, and then he started a modern record label, and he signed Stevie Nicks.
Yeah.
You had a band that you love called Poe.
Right, in the mid-90s, yes.
And who else was on Modern? Can you remember?
That's about all I remember.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, but Paul and I became really good friends, you know, just because I was one of the first to ever play that artist, because he really hadn't had anything since Stevie Nicks. So when we started breaking Poe, he and I just became really good friends. I'm looking forward to catching up with him. It's been a while since I talked to him.
And he's a good, good guy. And we had fun with Foghat in Houston. They were playing the Texas Jam or something, and we ended up having a softball game. And it was so much fun because we got all of retail, all of radio, all of press, and we put together this crazy softball game, and then we had barbecue. And I have to say that, in fact, I have a photo. It looks like there's 100 people in this photo.
Right.
So we'll have a lot of stories to tell with him. And then we have another podcast coming with Tommy Nast, who ended up getting into the music trades. So he can explain to us how the music trade thing worked with the charts and the magazine that you know, that charts the albums and their what else is there? It's like charts, right?
Yeah, it's pretty much charts and interviews and stories and the record label spending a gazillion dollars on ads.
Yes, that's it. The record companies are keep them fed.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
All right, man. Well, another great podcast. Thank you for tuning in. And again, the live radio shows, or the radio shows that you can listen to live, again, is www.klbjfm.com, 6 p.m. Central Standard Time on Sunday evenings.
Every Sunday. We'll talk to you then.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.